Some podcasts inspire their listeners. Some podcasts address important current events. Some podcasts make the world a better place. The Fish Golf Broadcast does the opposite, so buckle up for half an hour of wasted time. On this episode of the Fish Golf Broadcast, Scott Stokely flew across an ocean just to talk to me. Scott, what you thinking about?
I'm thinking about how much money I spent just to talk to you for 30 minutes divided by, like, I spent $8 a second to talk to you.
Okay. Well, I think that makes it abundantly clear that this podcast is, like, profitable and worthwhile. And, you know, any second now, I expect to be bought out by Jeff Bezos or some other billionaire.
Absolutely. In fact, start a disc golf podcast. You'll have 100,000 subscribers on your fourth episode.
It's true. And that's without doing any chintzy giveaways or hokey things like that.
Right.
In fact, I don't want you to tag your friends.
Yes. Don't tell anybody.
So, Scott, you spent all of this entire 2023 season playing in Europe and in Asia. How many different countries did you play in?
I went to 36 countries. I played in, I don't even know, about a dozen though, I guess, or maybe a little bit more.
Mm-hmm. Did you have wins in more countries than Paul McBeth this year?
In more different countries? It's hard to say. I mean, I played four tournaments in the UK and I won those. And then I played a couple tournaments in Asia that I won. I did not win on the Euro Tour, where the competition was a tad bit steeper, to say this, like, understatement. I had a third and a couple fifths, which I was proud of all three of those very much, but I didn't get any wins on the big ones.
Well, while we were playing a little bit, you were telling me about what the level of play looks like in Europe and in Finland in particular, and what that portends for the future.
Yeah, it's terrifying. You know, Finland has a population of 5 million, so you would expect there to be more top players out of the U.S. mathematically,
right? Of course.
That would be obvious, except I would argue there are probably more juniors playing in Finland total, not as a percentage, total, than there are in the U.S. The percentage of the population is, I mean, there's 50,000 juniors playing over there probably. It's insane. And every one of them throws correctly, which if you throw correctly and you keep playing, you get very good automatically.
Yeah, it turns out. And that kind of dovetails into what one of your greatest contributions to the disc golf community has been, is your teaching and clinics. As well as, is it the Scott Stokely instructional method?
Yeah, so I call it I hate the term Scott Stokely disc golf method because I feel like I'm talking about myself in the third person and nobody likes that guy. But I call it
Fishy
that.
Fishy likes it.
Okay, well, thank you. The method is not a different method of playing the game or throwing. You, me, every teacher, every pro probably agree 97% on the right and the wrong way to throw. Like, we know how to throw. The method is the process of getting there. What the method is not the end result. I don't teach the end result. The end result is watching a pro in slow motion and mimicking their mechanics and wondering why it didn't work for you. The method is a process I've developed to get there. It's a step-by-step systematic way of putting your body in the right position, getting one piece down, adding another layer to it, and it ending with, oh my God, that disc flew straight. So that's what the method is.
And you've also kind of recruited coaches who can help get players to that same point, right?
Yeah. I mean, the method is very, very teachable because it's a process. And because it's a process, it's somewhat of a formula. It can be learned and translated. It doesn't involve the skill of the experience of 30 years of teaching where I go, oh, your shoulder's dipping too soon there or something like that. It is At this part, you're looking for five things. So at this part of the throw, you pause. Is your weight above your hips? Is your wrist straight? Is your head with the body? Are you pulling across the strongest part of your chest? And are you planting your foot first? And because it's like at that step, it's a very well-defined formula, you can learn to look for those five things and then say you're doing those four, but you're not doing the one. Hmm. So it is teachable to the teachers.
So I talked with Matt Hammerston a little bit ago, and he also has been doing one-on-one instruction as well as clinics. And he had some interesting things to say about what he tries to do as a teacher and what makes a good coachable student. Scott, what do you think makes a good coachable student?
You have to trust the person teaching you and to buy into what they're teaching. You have to acknowledge that they're the expert. You need to let go and become putty in their hands. Now, that does not mean that every teacher is going to be successful or that every teacher is good, but you also have the option afterwards of saying, that didn't work for me. Okay, well, that wasn't the right fit. So you're not wired to life to this new technique. But if you are going to buy into someone teaching you, let go, let them teach you, trust them. And then if it works, keep trusting. If it doesn't work, you move on. It doesn't even mean that they're a bad teacher. I'm a huge supporter of teachers in general. I have a website called Disc Golf Lessons, where teachers that aren't certified in the Stokely Method can post they can post their names and what they teach on my site for free for the first 6 months just to promote the culture of teaching. Mm-hmm. And I am not the best teacher in the world for every single player. I am the best teacher in the world for the players who align with my thought process and my way of thinking. It doesn't mean that the local pro wouldn't do a better job than me. They very well may. So I encourage everybody to seek out teaching. And I then would say, I'm also very good, and I believe in it. I have an online class at scottstokely.net, for instance. You can sign up for it to take my online class. But I support all teachers, you know, especially the ones that are learning. You know, it took me a long time to get good at it. Just because they're not great at teaching doesn't mean they're not better than you and they can't help you. And it doesn't mean they're not going to also improve, or they can even learn teaching skills while they're working with you as they experiment with you. So seek out teachers. It doesn't have to be me.
Yeah, absolutely. Now, I think there's kind of a fallacy in disc golf, and this happens with course design as well, where it's perceived that the best players are the best teachers. And it sounds like you're just dispelling that entirely.
No, I would say they're borderline independent. I mean, there can be an overlap, but I mean, the best teachers or the best coaches, those are two independent things. I mean, you ask Simon how he throws so far, his answer will be, I don't know. He'll tell you that.
He might recognize certain parts of his throw, but like...
Yeah, and now he's being humble, right? Certainly Simon knows a lot about throwing, but if you ask him to teach you, he'll say, I'm not the best person to ask.
No, because he's got his cues that work at a super high level for somebody who's been doing this for 25 years.
Yeah, I mean, anybody can teach. Now, one thing that being a good player allows you to do, though, is allows people to buy into your teaching method. So, for instance, I have three people that teach my online, three people that teach my full-day seminars around the country. All three of them have been on the Disc Golf Pro Tour. That is not required to be a good teacher, but it certainly helps me promote their classes.
Yeah, absolutely. It's a little bit of street cred for them.
It is. Now, absolutely.
Now, I think the problem with that fallacy is that prospective students end up paying for access more than they're paying for actual knowledge. And the same thing is true with course design, where, you know, you might get a pro player who just sets up a pro course without thinking about who's actually going to be playing it day after day, or sets up a course to their own strengths.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, and it's hard to be humble because my gut tells me I could design a better course than anyone in the world. I've been playing for 46 years. I'm an expert at my craft. I've worked with all skill levels. But all I got to do is step back a minute and say, wait a second. It's like the Dunning-Kruger effect. Like, I don't know what I don't know about course design. I'm positive that John Houck and Eric McCabe and Greg Hosfeld and Dave McCormick, of course they're better at course design than me. Mm-hmm. It's insane to think that I'm as good as them, even though that ego part of me says, I should be, but I know I'm not. It's hard. It's a conflict.
Yeah, absolutely. And this definitely happens on the Pro Tour as well, where, you know, some mediocre, and like 10-15 is mediocre on the Pro Tour now, yeah, will point at something and say, well, that's invalid. And it's like, well, why? Like, why are you the authority on that? Like, are you thinking through the entire process there?
See, I almost look at it too, like course design is like art. Like when someone says, how do you feel about elevated baskets? I don't feel like I'm entitled an opinion about that elevated basket because the artist decided that that was necessary to make the hole that they created. That's their art piece. They created the hole. They've decided that that elevated additional challenge was necessary because that's the art they wanted me to appreciate.
Hmm.
And so my job is to go out and play that art and not to question it. And I even think the minute I start to think, well, that's bad design, maybe I'm going to get in my own head because I'm thinking about where the basket should be instead of where it is.
Experientially, I can tell you that's very true. Like I've basically had to make a rule for myself where there's design time and there's playing time, mm-hmm, and absolutely, they are entirely independent.
Yep.
Because if I get started thinking about like, well, why is that OB there? Or why is this, like, why put the basket here? Or this tree needs to go. Like, that's a problem because I'm going to be thinking about that instead of the upshot that I'm throwing.
Well, and everything's subjective too. That OB being too close is an opinion. That is not a fact. It is an opinion. If I recognize it as an opinion, not a problem. But you have an ego. I have an ego. We all have egos, mm-hmm, where we want to think of it as being right and wrong because our opinions we're so confident in. But they're still just opinions.
So stylistically, can you... What's different between American courses and European courses right now?
I've only been playing the Pro Tour courses. So sure. Based on the Pro Tour courses, I would say that they're very similar. They're really hard. They cause anxiety. And I mean this in the best possible way. You step up to the tee pad and you go, oh my God, how am I going to land this one safe?
Maybe not anxiety, but like stress. The designer's trying to build stress throughout the round to increase the test.
Yes. Now, the one probably bigger difference in the Nordic countries, and I want to say Scandinavia, but then I've been told many times that Finland is not Scandinavia. So we'll say Nordic countries, is that they have land with lots of trees. They don't have the big ball golf courses, or I'm not saying they don't have them, but they have a lot more land with the long, hard wooded courses, placement shot par fours. That is probably about the biggest difference is the absence of those courses, but the Maple Hill, Idlewild, Great Lakes Open type courses, that's what they have.
Mm-hmm.
They're great.
And I would assume, based on your previous statement, that you don't necessarily feel that that's superior to like long open courses. It's just a different type of art.
I love the variety of courses. You know, like right now at 54 years old, if I go to the OTB, the big long open course, I'm at a competitive disadvantage. That's not the course designer's fault. It's Mother Nature for making me older. And if I was younger and didn't throw as far, well, that's my fault for not throwing far. I think those courses have a place. They should be like tennis. Like that should be the clay court.
Yeah.
But let's have grass and hard court as well. And as long as there's a variety of courses, I don't mind that testing you sometimes. They belong.
But, yeah, absolutely.
And they kick my butt.
Eventually they kick everyone's butt. It's just.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Father Time's never lost a sporting event.
Yeah. So Scott, you're 54 and you had taken a pretty substantial break from disc golf. You've been back for like 7 years now, right?
Yes.
And you lied to me.
I'm Missy Gannon and I listen to the Fish Golf broadcast while I practice putt left-handed.
I'm James Conrad, and I listen to the Fish Golf broadcast while I'm taking a really long run up.
If you like where this show is headed, stick around for part two. We'll never barrage you with 11 minutes of droning external ads to start the show. So please support the Fish Golf broadcast by visiting discgolfbra.com for hats and other apparel. Fish stamp discs are available at fishdiscgolf.com and daddydiscgolf.com, and you can save 10% on upperparkdiscgolf.com with the code Andrew10 on backpacks and other items. And now, more lies and outrageous claims from our guest, met with calm reason by Fish. Yeah, you lied to me. Uh-huh.
I plead the fifth.
Okay. While we were playing today, we played Wills Park in Alpharetta, Georgia, old school course, mm-hmm. home with some champions. Scott told me he didn't think he had played a tournament in Georgia.
Except Savannah.
You played the Crucible.
Oh, that's right. Okay, I did play the Crucible.
Looking like an idiot.
I did lie. That course was so good.
The tournament is next weekend.
Really?
Like 10 days from now.
I'm running classes in Cincinnati.
Alas. Well, anyway, Scott, you dressed up like a buffoon, which is something that you're totally willing to do. It's kind of like you go all in on the bit when you decide you're going to do something.
Okay, so let me explain that. When I came back to the sport and I decided that I wanted to make a living in disc golf again, I had realized that I wasn't going to be ever 10-40 again, and I wasn't going to set any world distance records, and I was basically invisible. Nobody remembered me 13 years later. So I said, I got to do something to make a name for myself. And so I decided to be the most outrageous person I can be. I was crazy. I was controversial, very much on purpose. You can't find a mean-spirited thing. I was never derogatory. I never punched down. But I was outrageous. I had so much fun, didn't make a penny. Didn't make any money. So when I went back a couple years to see my daughter off to college, and when I came back, I basically reinvented my brand. It's okay, well, now I'm going to focus on teaching. And it turned out that, well, I'm good at it, but also I could build a brand around it. And now being outrageous would hurt my brand. To a point. I mean, yeah. I'm still me. I was never not me, but there's a lot of social media posts I don't make. And I make more money because I don't. Put it that way.
What's the most outrageous thing you'll say on this podcast right now? Remember, you paid $8 a second to get here.
$8 a minute, probably outrageous. Probably nothing. I'm a big part of my focus. We talked a little bit about anxiety, and I have anxiety far less now than I did a couple years ago. But when I took off to do this tour again and play frisbee for a living, I'm 50 years old or 51, and I don't want to be a greeter at Walmart when I'm 65. And I'm not knocking anybody that shows up and works hard, pays their bills. Don't misinterpret that. But I didn't know what the future held for me, and I had in my mind a decade to put something together before I start getting a little too tired to work too hard. And everything is very driven towards building that financial future so I can take care of myself in a couple years. So I have to table the outrageousness maybe for a while.
I think there's also, you speak about financial future, but you also played at a time when everything was on a shoestring. And even now, like, a lot of the players who are on tour aren't setting up a retirement fund. They're having a really good experiential time.
Yeah, and I think that's fine. If your plan is not to do frisbee for the rest of your life, I think. Okay, let me go off on a little rant here. Do you mind?
Oh, is this the most outrageous thing you'll say on a podcast?
I'll say the most outrageous thing. Okay, you have two scoreboards as a professional disc golfer. You're playing on two scoreboards. You have the disc golfer part of the scoreboard, which is how many strokes under par, what place at the tournament, what your rating is, do you get a tour card? That's the disc golfer part of being a professional disc golfer. But the other scorecard you're competing on is your bank account. And bank account also means future earnings, future potential earnings. That's a second scorecard that you're competing on. How much money am I making? How much money am I putting away? What future am I building for myself in this sport by building my brand? And that is the scorecard a lot of players on tour aren't focusing on. Understandably, I never even crossed my 50s never crossed my mind in my 20s. And so I get that. But as an athlete, you have a very small window traditionally to make money competing in your sport physically. But if you build a brand for yourself, you can make a career out of that name, whether you're starting a clothing line or being a course pro or, I mean, there's teaching disc golf. But there's any number of things you can do as a professional disc golfer beyond the scorecard number one part where you're competing on the tour. And so I wish more players would have that in mind, but I also understand that they're 20 years old and that's the last thing you're thinking about.
Sure. I think a lot of players kind of start down that path with like branding. You know, you're going to get apparel, you're going to get stamp on your disc, but it's just like this clumsy first step at setting up that future.
Yeah. Well, a funny quick aside. I got a funny question I get asked frequently because, you know, I do all my work in the special needs community. Now my passion is growing disc golf in developing countries. I got a bunch of projects I'm working on as we speak in developing countries that, you know, there's no money in this. It'll never be. This is something I do because I love it. And I've had many people ask me, well, how can we get some of the players on tour to start dedicating themselves to doing these, whatever you call it, socially positive causes or charity work, whatever you want to name it? And my response is, they shouldn't. They have a window of time in their 20s, especially as a professional athlete, where their responsibility is to be selfish. It is. You have right now to do everything you can as a competitive player to build your name, build your brand. You don't get a, and you know, I'm generalizing, but usually you don't get a second chance in your 40s to go back and be 25 again and 1040 rated. Like, you should be focusing on you, winning tournaments, and that should be, you know, build that. And then you can do all this other cool stuff once you're taking care of you first. And so I think that's what players need to do. As strange as it sounds, they need to be more selfish by taking care of themselves and building a future for themselves and thinking about themselves.
Hmm.
And that can be so misinterpreted. But
Can I push back on that a little bit?
Yeah.
Like, certainly it would be a big lift for somebody to, you know, go in the middle of the season to do something. But I think players still need to be connected to their local community and understand the level of work that goes into running events or maintaining a course. Like, all of the things that happen in the 358 days that we aren't on site at a Pro Tour stop. And I think players who don't get involved in something that is outside of themselves and benefits like the disc golf community or the world kind of miss that context.
Okay, so I don't disagree with that. This is a whole deep philosophical conversation about, does altruism exist, and, you know, does it need to exist for good things to happen, or can people have alternative motives for doing good things? I think those things can exist, but I think they could also be part of brand building. And I don't think that's wrong to do. If you're doing these things for your local community, with all the positives that come from that, but are you also simultaneously building a community of people that will buy your merchandise? I mean, it's very symbiotic to be taking care of yourself and giving back. You can't give back. Let me rephrase that. You can give back so much more the more successful you are. You know, like, I give away a ton of money, but I charge a ton of money for what I do.
Mm-hmm.
The more I charge, the more I can give away. Well, the building of my brand is allows me to charge more so I can do more good things. So I think I'm not suggesting that you shouldn't do good things every day of your life or that you can't be involved in things now, but it's almost short-sighted if that's the focus. The focus, I think, the more successful you are, the more you can do. So I'm not disagreeing with you. I think we're just talking about two different ways of getting there. And I think that as an athlete, you have a window. And your window should be, I need to win the world championship, so I should try to be doing that. And then plan for the rest.
Okay. Well, effective tomorrow, I will be answering no social media messages. My phone will be turned off.
There you go.
I'll be putting.
No, but that's not in your best financial interest. That is not in your best financial interest. That's not part of building the brand. With the teachers that I work with, like, I'll give you an example. Philip Bartholomew. He was going to be coaching for me. And I said, perfect. What organization are you going to benefit by doing this? So right off the bat, if you're working with me, you're going to be involved in an organization. Operation Smiles.
Okay.
Is something that he was going to then support with the earnings, some of the earnings from it. So I actually require a person to be socially conscious right off the bat. But that's also part of promoting yourself. Again, I think these work together. I think when you ask people to simply be altruistic because it makes you feel good, I think you get not as effective results as if you say, hey, you can do good things in a way that'll benefit you. Does a company give away more money when they can then put it in their marketing that they gave away? I think so. So are they wrong to market the fact that they're doing good things if the end result is they give away more money? I would argue that benefiting themselves creates more good. Maybe that's just like the capitalist in me.
Maybe. I mean, like, I think you've touched on several different, like, economic or political, like, viewpoints here. Like, there's the libertarian, be selfish kind of thing. Then there's the like...
But it's not in your best interest to be... I'm saying do what's in your best interest. Like, being selfish is not sitting around on the couch because you feel like playing video games. That's not being selfish. Being selfish is not playing video games and going to college to build a career for yourself. To me, that is the selfish. That is being selfish. So it's again, that's why the word selfish can be misunderstood or misconstrued. I think you can do more good the better a position you put yourself in life. And so I think that there, you know, if you're looking at the whole picture, which is the next 40 years, 50, 60 years of your life, then you can ultimately accomplish more good by becoming successful.
All right. Well,
that's a little off. Off topic, probably. But
Scott, I'm sure we could like chase down this rabbit hole and come to a consensus on exactly what level of altruism and like cynical brand building is appropriate both for individuals and businesses. This is a beautiful dog chasing a couple of unruly squirrels.
Yes,
and I'm rooting for all of them. Well, Scott, something I really do appreciate about you is that you are authentically yourself, and like you're kind of just inviting people to like appreciate you exactly as you are. You're not changing to fit them.
No.
So keep doing that. At least for yourself, it seems like you've got life figured out at some level.
Yeah, it took me 52 years. No, I'm a master at life. I've actually been advertising that I'm an expert at life because I failed for decades. but I've learned. Like I'm an expert at happiness because I figured out how to be happy. But it, you know, don't ask 25-year-old me. I didn't know what the hell I was talking about. I think I know now.
Well,
it just took 50 years.
Yeah. Can we?
Yes, I got to wrap this.
No. Well, let's put a pin in our calendar for 2053, and then we'll come back and we'll see how ignorant 54-year-old you was. All right. If you enjoyed this podcast, you can find me on Instagram and Twitter at fish58320. And if you hated this podcast, you want to yell at Scott about his opinions, where can folks find you?
They can go to scottstokely.net, and I have never deleted an opinion from my social media. I heart all of them, even the ones that disagree with me, because I want you to acknowledge that I appreciate you taking the time to give an opinion. I'm fine.
Great. And Scott, you'll be teaching clinics throughout this winter. Is that correct?
Yeah. Full-day seminars and clinics. Go to scottstokely.net. You can read all about them.
There you go.
Thanks, everyone.
That's all for this episode of the Fish Golf Broadcast. But be sure to check out previous episodes and subscribe wherever fine podcasts are sold. Check out Fish Golf Broadcast hats and other apparel at discgolfbra.com and badger your friends until they listen too. Join us next time as I goad yet another guest into starting a fight with another touring player, campsite host, or toll booth attendant on the Fish Golf Broadcast. We'll be right back.